Chairman Wright.
Here. Quorum present. First order of business is House Bill 312. Relating to harming a police dog. Anybody here from the house? The only problem I have with this is if a person intentionally kills a dog, perhaps they have to intentionally kill it because it's injured so bad that they can't do anything else. And, perhaps the vet or whoever takes care of those kind of things might have to put the dog to sleep. Amend it in some fashion to just take care of that problem. I wonder if we should put that in the, I suppose we should put that in the definition section, or is there some way we can amend that term actually?
Could
we put an unauthorized person?
You picked that.
First, you could describe a harmless police dog in first degree if an unauthorized person intentionally kills or causes serious to his own takes care of the first part, not the second part.
Well, what you say is something like that is a defense to a prosecution under the chapter. Killing occurs because of a prior injury or ailment.
Well, the same way in the dog's training, maybe he's jumping him over a fence or grabs him or something and unintentionally breaks the leg or something like that.
Well, unintentionally,
takes it there.
But that would probably be done by a veterinarian anyway.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, the present statute involving cruelty to animals is, by the way, it's a Class A misdemeanor. So all we're doing here, in a sense, is raising it. You got a police dog instead of a Class A misdemeanor. It's a Class C felony. But anyway, that statute says, quote, it is a defense to a prosecution or the section of the conduct of the defendant conformed to accepted veterinary practice. I think it's accepted veterinary practice to destroy an animal. I think we should insert the same language in here, Mr. Chairman. So we would just, for Mr. Gabrielli's information, we would insert the language contained in present statute 11.61.140B1.
Person other than those specified under such and such. All we need to do is put in the section. Person other than.
Well, this allows anyone to have this defense, Mr. Chairman, not just veterinarians. If your conduct conforms to accepted veterinary practice, even if you're a layman or the policeman himself who may want to have to destroy his own dog, or if that conforms to accepted veterinary practice.
So what is your suggestion?
That we simply add a subsection C to 1156705, and that subsection would read, there's a defense to prosecution under this section that the conduct of the defendant conformed to accepted veterinary practice.
Is that agreeable with the committee?
Yes.
I move that you report the committee substitute containing the senator's amendment with individual recommendation.
I'm going to do pass.
All right. All right.
I'm supposed to say meow, meow.
Is there a top priority?
Next is HJR 5. This is a amendment to the Constitution relating to enrollment of regulations by the legislature. We have Art Peterson here from the Attorney General. Do you just want to say argument number 5, Art, and forget it?
Yeah,
I don't know, so I guess Fritz hasn't heard that argument.
I've heard it.
Would you come forward, please, and identify yourself and give some testimonies you believe to be relevant?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Art Peterson, Assistant Attorney General. It, of course, is no surprise that the Department of Law opposes this resolution. You should all have, by this time, I think, a little memo letter from me to the chairman, to which I attach my letter of an earlier date to the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Trying to keep this as brief as possible, there are just four basic points. When the chairman says, do I have number 5, I suppose I could always come up with another one, if you wish. I gather that there's strong legislative support for this resolution. I would urge you to reconsider the actual need, the particular problems that you think this resolution might be addressing. The voters have already overwhelmingly rejected a virtually identical resolution in 1980 by a vote of 82,000 and some to something over 58,000. And we think that the voters probably knew what they were doing in rejecting that resolution, that constitutional amendment.
That was particularly after the explanation by the Attorney General.
Well, I've heard that charge, and I've looked at that voter pamphlet, and sometimes when I go to these little meetings on the subject, I bring that along. This time I didn't. I don't think that there's any problem with that. If you're talking about the negative argument that appeared in the voter pamphlet, that I think might have been found persuasive by the voters, apparently more persuasive than the affirmative argument made by Representative Parr, I think it was Senator Parr at that time.
I found your, in all honesty, I did find that your letter was well done. You presented a good argument, although I don't agree with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really don't have anything to add to the letter. I assume you've all read the letter. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond. I suppose just in summary, we believe that there are many procedures currently available for legislative oversight of administrative regulations. There are many procedures. And we do not need to go to this shortcut approach that has the effect of changing law without the protection of the Constitution's lawmaking procedures that you have for bills when you pass legislation.
Mr. Chairman, what are the procedures?
First of all, there are many, many notices. Under the APA, notice goes to every individual legislator, the chair of the relevant committees for the particular subject of the regulation, to the staff of the Administrative Regulation Review Committee, to the Legislative Affairs Agency. There are opportunities for legislators to participate in the discussion, the development of the regulations, apart from that official notice, apart from the formal public hearing or formal written comment period. There's a provision of the Administrative Procedure Act for the petitioning of an agency to amend or repeal a regulation.
I think the flaw in your argument comes though that, and as an interested observer of the legislative process for myself for the last going on 20 years, I noticed that when the administration wants to get a change in existing law and they can't get it during a legislative session, They wait until after the session is over, and then by regulation, they make that change.
Well, Senator Ray, if they do so, and if it is approved...
And then it takes it away from the legislative body, anything there, because it's whoever proposes the regulations, they make the determination whether the public is in favor or opposed. So in other words, you're superseding our responsibility, the legislative responsibility, right? That's what it comes down to me.
If we were to try to supersede that, we could not legally do so. There is a statute, as you know, in the Administrative Procedure Act that requires all administrative regulations to be consistent, first reasonably necessary, and consistent with the statutes that those regulations are implementing. And there may be difference of opinion on whether a particular regulation accurately or appropriately implements that statute, but clearly you have the driver's seat in the legislature. If you enact a statute that governs a subject, you can set guidelines, prohibitions, limitations. You control that, and the gaps for implementing that statute are filled by administrative regulations. If they are not consistent with the statute, we don't approve them in the Department of Law.
Well, we're not talking about consistency, but doing something that is within the purview of the statute, but something that the legislature does not approve and does not approve during legislative session. And then you just go ahead and announce that you're going to have a hearing on the regulation, and you go through the thing. Perhaps we'll have to go back through, make it a chore, and go back through the statute and change that so that it don't give you the regulatory power that regulations have the full force and effect of law. We'll just say they don't have it, and you're just adopting them subject to the approval of the legislature or the kicking out of it by the legislature. That's essentially what we're doing here, trying to do.
Well, he mentions the fact that, you know, there's public notice being given and these publications, but we're overwhelmed with these. We have, 12, 13 departments, and every day there's a suggested change in the regulations. And for one of us, or any group of us, to sit down to analyze each one of us is impossible. You just so you're like relying upon, well, you have plenty of notice, you can voice your opinions, and we simply don't have the time to do it.
Most of the time, all you have is a statutory citation.
And we don't know really what happens until these regulations go into effect, and then we get the response from the constituents out there. They're the one. By far, our biggest complaints, at least in my office, is regulations by state government.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to that?
Let me finish mine. And at least 75% of my complaints are due to regulations imposed by different departments of state government. Now, I'm convinced that the voters out there did not realize that they were given the opportunity at that particular time to have the legislative have a definite part in rejecting those regulations when we come into session. I don't think they realized that question. I don't think that the legislature tried to appraise them of the value of having this amendment. I think when they once realized that a lot of their problems can be addressed by the legislature in session, that bill supported, because that is by vast majority of our complaints is due to the regulations that the administration or departments put in effect. That's 75% of our work.
Mr. Peterson, Mr. Chairman. A couple of comments. You threw in a comment about the citations, and when you see those, if we miss them, I wish you would call them to my attention, because we try to keep something more descriptive and more helpful in the public notice, not just a citation. So I agree, that's not a good approach. The drafting manual advises against that, gives examples, and so on. So we're trying to correct that. But that problem is not addressed by this resolution. On Senator Eliason's point, it seems to me that addressing the particular problem you've just described, the legislature created the Administrative Regulation Review Committee in 1975, a committee specifically assigned to go through regulations and try to make the kinds of decisions, the kinds of analysis that you're just talking about. A year ago, Chapter 1 of the session laws, in finding that didn't seem to be working as well as had been hoped, Chapter 1 added reference to the particular standing committee with subject matter jurisdiction of the regulations. So individual committees, so that not every legislator is reading every public notice that comes along. It seems to me like a reasonably good system if each of those committees does its work. Certainly, the full ramifications of a particular regulation are brought home after it's been put into effect. And certainly, that's a better time or a more effective time for people to see exactly what's happening. I agree with you that you can't always anticipate every kind of problem. But the executive branch has the same problem. They try to analyze the statute that they're implementing. They try to analyze what kinds of administrative needs, public needs, there may be in implementing that statute, and they adopt a regulation. They do it with public notice, with opportunity for public comment, try to encourage as much analysis as possible. There's a statute that, in so many words, requires them to consider the testimony presented. And the Department of Law is constantly reminding them to do so. So they do that. If they make a mistake, or if you don't like the policy adopted, the legislature, as I mentioned before, is in control. You pass a statute to correct that, to set the limitations, to set the policy in a different direction, to impose guidelines. The idea of taking this shortcut by means of a concurrent resolution that simply annuls the reg and says, nope, you guessed wrong that time, administrative agency, do something different. You're not really providing them the tool that they need to execute the statutes.
You mentioned the fact that we could pass statutes to address the issue, right, which is considerably different than passing resolution nullifying it.
Certainly.
The statute has to be approved by the governor's office, right?
That's right, or you override
his veto. His people are the one that are creating the problem to start with, so if we do go through the legislative process and it's zapped by the governor, we're back to square one. That's the problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're not back to square one because you have the opportunity to override the veto if you have two-thirds vote.
Oh, come now.
Senator Joseph? Well, Mr. Chairman, I have to disclose I'm the source of the problem. I was the lawyer for a live voluntary and failed to, I guess, do an adequate job in the Supreme Court because I feel very strongly about this. I think Senator Nelson has expressed the concerns very well. And so far as the argument about the publication of the rules is concerned, it is somewhat analogous to something I think Justice Jackson said when there was a discussion, in an opinion, when there was a discussion about how farmers were put on notice by the Federal Register of a certain rule from the Department of Agriculture, and I think he said that a farmer could either plow his field or read the Federal Register, but he couldn't do both. And I think that's one of the problems here as far as the notification is concerned. Secondly, this is, and I think your letter concedes it to Mr. Bussell, at least a quasi-legislative authority that you are exercising, or that the agency's exercise. It is the filling of the interstices or gaps that are left by the statute. And I agree with Senator Eliason that to say to us, either don't worry because the Department of Law seeks to make the rules consistent with legislative intent, or don't worry because you can pass a statute which the governor can veto with no override. I don't think those are really adequate. Clear around this table, those are not adequate solutions from a legislative point of view. I really can't see, I think it will be used sparingly, but I really can't see any major problem with this. Why we cannot simply have, as part of our oversight, the right to look back on the regulations and say that regulation is not consistent with legislative intent or inappropriate, and not. I don't really see the problem. We give notice of that action too. The public, by the way, we're not doing that in the midst of the dark night. I mean, that's a public action also.
Well, the key to the whole thing, Senator Gilson, I think it's adequately expressed it. The key is the governor's veto. That's the key to the whole thing. Otherwise, we could just pass a bill and we wouldn't be worried about resolutions because we have to pass resolutions during the legislative session anyway. But the key to it, and the crux of the whole thing, is the governor's veto. And it's very hard for the legislature to override a governor's veto for the simple reason that he holds considerable power, and wields considerable power over the budget and over other measures of law that aren't particularly necessary to him, but are could be crucial to the person that's putting it in. And he still has that veto power over that. So he wields a good deal of power through the Constitution. That's exactly the way it was. But we have to counterbalance that in some manner, and this is the only way we can do it, we feel, and have a fair shot at it. And if he doesn't like if he has a resolution, or if they put in a regulation, and we annul it by resolution, he can always come through himself with proposed legislation for our consideration. In other words, that's the way it's supposed to be. Is we put in legislation for our consideration, and he does the same thing, the court system does the same thing. So this, we would just put it back to square one and let him come with his proposal. Language, and you can go ahead and act on that.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, two comments, one addressing your point and one Senator Josephson's. With regard to the vehicle used in overriding the administrative regulation, as you know, the Constitution specifies these various procedures for bill passage that include requirement of three readings on separate days, the recording of the ayes and nays on the journal, and so on. Those provisions do not apply to resolutions. of course, the gubernatorial veto provisions.
They don't also apply to regulations, and that's what the governor is doing, is legislating by regulation. Now, that's a specious argument, my determination. Your argument turns around, how does the administration and those people make regulations that have the full force and effect of law that we have to repeal by law, but they only do it by administrative action.
That administrative action is very narrowly regulated, very closely regulated by the legislature in the Administrative Procedure Act, so that there are very strict requirements of public notice, hearing, opportunity for public comment, deferred effective date after the regulation is adopted. The administration cannot adopt regulation without going through those provisions, subject to certain exceptions.
I'm very familiar with the Administrative Procedures Act, having been the chairman of the ABC board for some time. That didn't stop us from making regulations.
Well, it's not supposed to stop people from making regulations. It's supposed to assure the opportunity for public participation in the process, and I think it does that. As to Senator Josephson's point about you can't plow and read the Federal Register at the same time, I think that's a good comment. But the only notice published is not just in the Federal Register or just in a single place. Our Administrative Procedure Act includes provision, there are eight paragraphs there specifying the eight different places for publication of the notice, including those several ones to legislators or legislative committees, as I mentioned earlier. But they include direct mailings to interested people, people who've requested to be on a mailing list, other individuals or organizations the agency might think would be interested in that subject. It's a good effort by the legislature to specify what the procedures are for the administrative agency to adopt regulations. And sometimes an agency will make a mistake, not give notice adequately. We reject the regulations on that basis. But they do try. They have a drafting manual that goes into some detail in telling them how to implement that statute.
But the people elect such as we to come down here and make laws. They expect us to make the laws, and then what laws that we make most of the time are pretty well advertised, particularly if they are controversial. They don't elect the administrators. All the administrators are appointed, except for the governor, and all the rest of those people are all appointees of his. So I think that if we get down to your argument, let us legislate and you guys administrate.
Senator, that is exactly my point. You should legislate. You should not try to make an executive branch decision. On those administrative regulations, they are one of the tools that the executive uses in executing the statutes. And that tool, by being something of general application and applicable prospectively, are, in effect, legislative.
Nice try, Art, but I think that Joe's got a brief.
Art.
Yes, Joe.
You, let's be serious. You take the Alaska Constitution, and you give anybody, and there are plenty of people who would love to dearly try, the office of the governor with the line item appropriation that we've got, which the President of the United States doesn't have, with the right to appoint and have serve at his pleasure every cabinet officer, except perhaps the Fish and Game Commissioner and the Education Commissioner, who are in a little different category, but he certainly influences that, as we know. They serve at his pleasure, all the power of boards and commissions, the right to veto, a requirement that it takes 3/4 vote to override the veto on money items. And you can't tell me that this little old housekeeping change we want to make here is going to cripple anybody worth his salt or her salt who sits in the office of the governor. I mean, it's ridiculous. This, in the first place, the agency can come back and promulgate a new regulation, incidentally, because as you point out, we're not writing the regulation. So I really don't think this is a big deal as far as separation of powers, but it gives us a handle. And as I remember in the Alive case, there was a change in the regulatory policy. I believe that what happened was, and it's been a long time, that the agency, the Department of Revenue, understood legislative intent for a period of years in such and such a way, and then changed the policy, in changing the interpretation of the same statute. And the legislature was exercised about that. Now, you know, that seems to me the kind of thing that this would address. So we don't have policy changes made in interpreting law under the guise of interpreting laws that are not consistent unless the legislature changes the policy. I don't think it's a big deal. And I think the governor's going to have plenty of powers, and I think Mr. Sheffield will want to run again, even though the people have a chance to do this. I think they'll still feel it's got a lot of juice.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just make a comment on that. To characterize this constitutional amendment as a little housekeeping amendment seems to me, in the 17 years that I've been closely watching this legislature, to be the epitome of housekeeping amendments getting the most legislative attention and the most legislative fire and heat of any housekeeping amendment I've ever seen. It really isn't a housekeeping amendment. One of the problems with it, in making that simple negative statement, as Senator Josephson will recall, that particular Department of Revenue regulation involved in the live voluntary case involved several different elements. One was the dollar amount, which needed to be put in current terms. Another was the cumulative effect of a number of different lotteries. For those who might not be familiar with it, it's the regulation involved permits, that the limitation on the prizes connection with lotteries and the issuance of permits to hold lotteries. There were three elements to the regulation: the dollar amount, the cumulative effect of it, and the time period during which that would cumulate. When the legislature came along and annulled that regulation and said, no, it's not really giving the executive any guidance in executing the law. If they change the dollar amount from 50,000 to 100 or to 20, is that going to do the trick? Will the same regulation, but with that dollar figure changed, will that be okay? We don't know.
You never asked.
Well, I don't know that that's true either. That's
well, is it true that the Attorney General's office, in conference with the governor, when they find some measure that is passed by the legislature that they don't, it's a controversial measure, and it's a close question, has it ever happened that the Attorney General's office said, that, in our opinion, is unconstitutional, and we're not going to administer it?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, don't you think that's against the Constitution?
No.
Oh,
we're required by the Constitution
again,
to uphold the Constitution.
Oh, no, but it also says in order for you to do anything with legislative acts, you must have a court determination, not your own determination.
Well, it's not worded quite that way, Senator.
I find it is.
There's a provision there that provides for the governor to bring an action to enforce the law or to uphold the Constitution. There's also a provision in the Constitution requiring all of us who are employed by the government to take an oath to uphold the Constitution. In addition, the attorneys in the Department of Law take their oath upon admission of bar to uphold the Constitution.
Let's not get walk into that. What I'm saying is that that's his determination on what the Constitution says, not what the court says. And it's the court's duty by the Constitution to make that requirement or to make that judgment, not the Attorney General.
The Attorney General is required by statute to give advice on the law.
Let me ask this, since we're asking for trade secrets. Do you think it's ever happened that a governor says to an Attorney General, the legislature's passed this bill, I don't really like the policy, but I think the people want it, or I don't think for because it's going to offend this one or that one, I don't want to veto it. And he is advised, don't sweat it, because the rules and regulations can divert what the legislature tried to do or produce a different result than they expect by the way this bill is enforced. Do you think that ever happened?
I don't think there's been any direct attempt to go contrary to the legislative intent. If it were, the regs could not be approved by the Department of Law under Section 60 of the APA, because it would be inconsistent with the statute. If the statute is not clear, and the governor has a particular policy point of view, the regulations, I'm sure, would reflect that policy point of view. But if the legislation is clear, I'm not aware of any instance where the governor has said, I don't like that legislation, let's go off in a different direction, and that got approved by the Department of Law. No, I'm not aware of that happening.
But you don't expect to be in on every decision, do you?
I don't, no, too many as it is, but...
Senator Lyons?
Well, you know, I just like to get back to basics. Obviously, none of us are infallible, including the administration or the people who work for administration. But it seems to me that if, in effect, that our constituency was adamantly opposed to certain regulations that had been imposed upon them by government, and that a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate, one of those regulations changed or annulled. What's so obnoxious about that? It seems to me that logically you would approve it, unless the whole system is haywire.
That gets down to the crux again, Senator Eliason. It's the difference between a bill and a resolution. The governor can't touch the resolution where he can veto the bill, and that's where...
And we're talking about the reflections of the general public.
That's
what
that's
we're
the only
talking
reason
about.
We put
we're
it
not
in.
Talking about technicalities. We're talking about the people out there are being harassed in many cases by regulations that none of us approve.
But isn't
you're saying that we can't, you know, we can't do anything about it?
That's how we're motivated.
No, I'm not.
You mean, that's where our original motivation is,
right,
to come in with them.
Now, we don't put in concurrent resolutions because we think they're great ideas. We do it as a result of people telling us that they have problems.
And if those problems don't exist, there's enough spread of representation throughout the state that those resolutions won't be passed.
And what is wrong if you have a majority of both bodies saying that's a bad one? Let's get rid of it.
Well, because as the court said in the Alive Voluntary case, when the legislature acts to change the law, it has to follow the lawmaking procedures of the Constitution. Those procedures do not apply to resolutions.
Well, we're saying
so
it's
resolutions is a shortcut.
Hmm? Okay, that's what we're trying to do.
He gets lost there.
Yeah.
Well,
the laws and regulations get a little mixed up.
Chairman, but when the administration changes the law,
that's okay.
No, we do it in accordance with the Administrative Procedure Act. We implement the law, we don't change the law.
Well, we
let's all gang up on ours and beat up on
Well, then when you change the regulation by the legislature, you're changing the implementation of the law, not the law itself, correct? Because that's what you're doing. You're implementing the law when you put out a regulation.
That's
if the legislature were to overturn that regulation, is changing the implementation of the law, not the law.
That's right.
Okay.
But it should be changing the statute, because legislating is the legislature's business. Executing those laws is the executive's business.
Yeah, but you add things that aren't in the statute. You add things
by
regulation that are not in the statute. It's your interpretation and your slant of what you want to do with it, and not necessarily what the legislature wants to do with it.
When the legislature
as the originator in the first place of what we want in there, and we see that the administration is not following what our intent is, then we say, no, don't do it like that. Do it some other way.
Yeah, tell us the other way. Legislate.
Well,
like the legislature should.
But who tells you in the first place? Who tells you in the first place to make the regulations the way you want
them? The legislature
does. Oh, no, we don't. No, we don't.
No.
We just pass a law and you put in the administrative regulations the way you think that it should be done. We say, no, that isn't the way we want it done, so we're going to annul those regulations, come up with a different approach. Here's what we suggest. You write them and that's it. And if you don't do it again, we'll annul it again.
When the legislature passes a statute saying, we are hereby adopting a program protecting air quality, stream quality, whatever, and it then adds a section, as it invariably does, the commissioner, department, whatever it may, shall adopt regulations necessary to implement this chapter. And the commissioner adopts regulations saying in streams you may not have more than X number of parts per million of a pollutant. That's obviously not in the statute, but you have obviously given the commissioner that authority to put it in the regulations.
But if it's a ridiculous regulation, or it's not conforming, or it's too strict, and it can be proven and shown, then we say, no, you're wrong on that. Do something else.
That's right. You can enact a limitation.
But you people are not that dumb and blind. You can come and ask us what our intent is.
And we do that all the time. However, an individual legislator cannot speak with the authority for the entire legislature.
I can't believe you're advocating that we repeal a law to change a regulation. That's stupid.
You don't need to repeal the law.
That's what you said. Address it legislatively.
Yes. Amend it. Set guidelines. Set limitations or whatever that you think are appropriate.
If we have a problem with you.
I think there is a diversity of opinion.
I think
Thank you very kindly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Does anybody else wish to give any enlightenment on this subject? Chair, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I not to belabor this, but I do want to say that the letter of Mr. Peterson acknowledged that at least some authorities regard regulation making as quasi-legislative power. It isn't just a matter of executive action. It is a mixture of functions. There is one point that I think we might want to consider. Mr. Peterson raised the question of notice and in the adoption of a concurrent resolution. I would not object to an amendment. I'd like to know what the other members of the committee feel, which would require that in this particular instance the resolution be read on three separate occasions. I think there are two advantages to that. One, it anticipates an argument from the opponents of the resolution that we can do this, and under our uniform rules, a concurrent resolution doesn't require three readings without adequate notice to the...
We would have to make a change in the uniform rules, and we could do that very easily to say a concurrent resolution annulling the administrative regulation must be read three times by the legislature.
We could, but except that at the present time we don't have the power to use to do that. We don't have the annulment power, so you can't go to the voters and say that's the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing is that that would put before the voters, I was one of the 58,808 informed voters who voted for the resolution.
Well, why don't we, do you want to amend this, 916, after the date, the concurrent resolution, after three readings is approved by both houses?
Can't we handle it, and said these types of records should be handled the same way a bill is handled.
Yeah, he has the citation, let me see. This is subject to Mr. Gabriel's refinement, but the legislature, by a concurrent resolution approved by a majority vote upon separate readings on separate days in the same manner as provided in Article 2, Section 14, may annul a regulation. That's what I
have a problem with that. Art doesn't agree with that, but
I have a problem with that.
Does that
solve your problem?
No, it doesn't. It just compounds his problem. We do it that way.
Mr. Chairman, if I may offer a comment from the sideline, if you are thinking of amending this resolution, another one would be the recorded ayes and nays on the journal to assure the accountability to the public that you're trying to serve.
I think we handle it, again, should use language handling the same way a bill would be handled.
No, because then you get it too close to the idea that it can be vetoed by the thing.
In the legislature only, I'm talking
about. Yeah, I know, but I mean the inference is
they might adopt regulations
to
do it.
They'll adopt regulations to do it.
I understand.
Do you have any objection to that?
No, I don't have any objection to that. The only objection I've got is political. You know, 3 years ago it went down 60-40, and what's going to change now?
The people do not understand, at least the people in my constituency that I've talked to, a good number of them, didn't even understand what it meant.
Well, why are they going to understand next year when they didn't understand 3 years ago?
We intend to educate them better.
Is that a threat?
Yes.
I haven't had many cases of this, but I've had voters in campaign meetings say to me, how come this is allowed to happen, you know, and I asked them about this and they did not understand.
No. Well, I agree, but I you know, with all deference to your educational abilities, Mr. Chairman, I just wonder if...
Well, if we keep doing it enough
times. Like the capital vote, right? We're just thinking about it. Mr. Chairman, after this went down a few years ago, people who had complained to me in my district about regulations, I called attention to the fact they had the opportunity to do something about the last election, and they said, well, how? And I said, well, it was before you. They said, well, I didn't realize it.
That's true.
So, you know, it's a matter of education, and I personally didn't take any time to go out and try to explain what it was all about, but I will this time.
Yes, I will too. Subject to the amendment, is there any opposition to the amendment as proposed, putting in the three readings and also the ayes and nays should be recorded?
Fine.
Under no objection to that, under that condition, the chair will entertain a motion.
I move the committee substitute incorporating the amendment with individual recommendations.
Any objection? How many do pass? No rec?
No rec.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I hope that nobody is taking undue advantage of your tender years.
It's gotten pretty untender over the years.
Somebody described you as having a height like a rhinoceros and a disposition to match. Is there any truth to that?
No, I don't think in either direction.
No, okay.
Or either element,
rather. When you wrote a summary of the legislation you reached in your file and pulled out to change the date and sent it down to us?
It's become a familiar presentation.
Thanks
again.
Next order of business, the Senate Joint Resolution number 12, opposing extension of the provisions of the Export Administration Act of 1979 that effectively bans the export of Alaska North Slope oil. Okay, is there any...
Washington scene. I'm going to speak to this.
Chair. Steve Silver, would you come forward, please? Identify yourself, your affiliation, and the letter of testimony due to the zone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Silver. I'm an attorney. I represent Alaska Lumber Pulp Company. ALP is an Alaska corporation located in Sitka, which is actively working in Washington to change existing law, which effectively prohibits the export of Alaskan crude oil, which is transported through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
And who are you representing?
ALP, Alaska Lumber Pulp Company.
What is their interest in this?
Well, Alaska Lumber Pulp Company is involved as a corporation that does business in the Pacific Rim. We export timber to Japan and other nations in the Far East. And we have talked to people in the Far East who are interested in exporting Alaskan crude, and we decided to undertake the proposition to see if we could make that a reality.
Does this have any connections with raw lumber shipped to Japan?
Only in the raw lumber shipped to Japan. When you say raw, as you know, under the federal law, ALP takes all of its timber virtually from federal lands. It must be go through a primary manufacturing provision before it can be shipped. That's right. But beyond that, it's a resource, one of Alaska's resources, and oil is a resource. And we believe that oil can lead the way to opening markets in the Pacific Rim for other resources as well, such as natural gas or agricultural products, coal.
I just wonder how much of your company is owned by Japanese interests.
The company is owned by, it's an American subsidiary of a Japanese company.
Okay. AOP also has interest in fish processing.
That's right.
So, you know, it's a multi.
Is this a multinational combine?
Not exactly. It's primarily owned by Japanese interest and manned and worked by American Alaskan labor.
Maybe I can state as background. Senator Eliason has said ALP also owns Harbor Seafoods in Southeast Alaska. And ALP began as what was called a national project in Japan. It was the first investment in the United States by Japan following the war. It was started by General MacArthur when he was in Japan as a way of providing trade between the United States and Japan and providing timber products to Japan, because if you can well imagine, the forests in Japan were decimated by bombing in World War II. And we've been operating in Alaska since 1954. ALP believes passage of a resolution by the legislature indicating its interest in the export of Alaskan oil would be helpful to our efforts in Washington, D.C. We are working actively to seek changes in the law which would permit export of at least a limited portion of Alaskan oil. And we think that we have the administration, the Sheffield administration has come out in support of the issue. And we think that an indication of support from the legislature would also be helpful. We do suggest modifications in the resolution before you. In your packet, we provided an essence of committee substitute, which we think more properly would help us more. It frames the resolution, I think. For identification, it doesn't have a number. It just begins, be it resolved by the legislature of the state of Alaska. It frames the issue in the national perspective, which we think is the most advantageous for eliciting support in Washington. The present resolution speaks more to the Alaskan interest, and while it properly states the Alaskan interest, we're trying to sell the proposition in Washington by showing that there is a national interest as well as an Alaskan interest in the export of Alaskan oil. The resolution is, as we suggest, deals with a number of advantages to the nation, increasing the national security, increasing trade with Pacific Rim nations, providing incentives for future exploration of North Slope reserves, raising federal and state revenues by lowering the wellhead price of oil, which is determined by transportation costs, and reducing oil costs to consumers over the long term through the identification of new fields. We've discussed this resolution with this proposed substitute with representatives of Senator Farenkamp's staff, and they've indicated no problems with having this substituted. And we've also discussed this resolution with John Katz, who runs the governor's office in Washington, and he has been provided a copy of the resolution and also indicates no problem with the resolution.
Your third,
my testimony.
Steve, your third whereas. The export of Alaska crude oil will result in a large increase in federal and state revenues by raising the wellhead price of Alaska crude oil without increasing tax rates to any party or cost to the American consumer. If we have, if we're shipping the oil out and there's a, it becomes a, the oil glut, which I don't know if there is one or not, some people seem to think there is, but I haven't seen any decrease in the prices in Southeast Alaska. It would seem to me that if we diversify, or if we sell part of our oil over there, then we might be the shortage here, and then that would raise the cost
Well, there are two answers to that. First, before I deal with the answers, I thank you for in reading this. I don't know how it escaped me before. The word raising should be lowered. That's a typographical. Because you raise revenues by lowering the wellhead price, as I'm sure all of you are familiar with.
That's right.
It is correct? No, you're right.
No, that is raising the wellhead price.
Yeah, raising the wellhead price. I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, I guess there are two answers. First, as I understand it, specifically to Southeast Alaska, of which I am a resident, I do not believe Alaskan oil is specifically utilized in any of the supplies, although I'm not positive of that. So I don't think that specific to Southeast Alaska any export would affect prices in Southeast Alaska, or even could. The larger answer is that oil is sold at a world market price, and it's set primarily by what's called a marker price, Saudi Arabian crude. And any oil that would be replacing Alaskan oil would anywhere in the country would be sold at that price with any changes for differential in quality. What? As to Alaskan crude specifically, I think state law still would be in effect, which would not permit any use of Alaskan oil for export unless in-state processing needs were met beforehand.
Would this have any relationship to the to Alaska's oil revenue, oil share? In other words, if we're going to do this, why don't we just wait off on Tesoro and Chevron and the rest of them and just hold that oil and sell it to Japan if we think we got a good thing going and we'll get more money for it, right?
Well, ALP supports the Tesoro contracts. We don't view them as being any conflict one way or the other. Again, the existing state processing laws will determine whether or not a contract should be let for in-state needs or whether or not oil is available for export. And it's not our position that the Tesoro or Chevron contract should be not approved to allow oil to be exported. We think they're two totally separate matters.
Mr. Chairman, I'm advised that the overall scheme is that the about 1.6 million barrels would stay in domestic flow, and about 200,000 barrels a day would be available for export.
That's correct. The provision we're specifically looking at in Washington is a very limited amount, approximately 200,000 to 300,000 barrels of existing oil and new field production to the extent it becomes available.
Senator,
first time you recognize me all session. Back to third where I asked, I really would question whether it would be wise to discuss wellhead prices and the effect on the federal revenues and especially the state revenues. I think that's going to be a rather tender spot in Washington, D.C. I think I prefer mentioning an original resolution where the reason for going to that market is that we're shipping it all the way to the Panama Canal, which is increasing the cost. I think that's the whole message we're trying to get across in Congress. So whether I'm talking about wellhead price on one hand, I think we ought to explain what's happening at the present time. It's really exchange.
Whereas inflammatory. It brings a lot of questions to my mind.
As a third whereas causes you trouble, I think we are not so strongly wedded to this language that we wouldn't be happy to see a change. It would make you more comfortable.
Well, there is an amendment. I don't know if it was incorporated. Was it incorporated? Which would have said, whereas wavering demand coupled with lack of adequate refining capacity on the West Coast, as well as the absence of any pipeline from the East Coast, have led to an oil surplus in the Pacific Allocation Defense District 5, the West Coast, requiring Alaska crude oil to be shipped to the eastern United States through the Panama Canal.
And that'd be a fine substitute for the third whereas if the committee so desires.
I don't know where that one came from, but the original resolution says the same. 16 through 23, pretty well explains it.
Even though it makes sense, I could just see the political ramifications, at least in my mind. The guy that's sitting there in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or someplace saying, yeah, sure, those Alaskans there, and now they want to grab more dough. We can't even make anything. They want to send it over there and make more money. And by golly, we ought to take that money away from them anyway to start with.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe striking the word state revenue would satisfy that. We do think it's a strong selling point in Washington that this would raise federal tax revenues. And we put in state revenues, very frankly, so that we wouldn't be accused of trying to hide that. that fact, because it will raise state revenues also. But we don't feel that strongly that about the whole whereas clause to begin with, or about the use of state revenues.
I would feel a lot better if you sent one back there that said that even though Alaskans are not necessarily in agreement with this thing, we recognize the need to assist the rest of the United States, and we'll willingly give up whatever we have to do in order to make the prices lower for them. That's the kind of resolution I'd like to see go back, instead of saying, if you allow Alaska to do this, we're going to be able to export coal and natural gas and agricultural products and all this good stuff. In other words, I'd like to make it look like Alaska is going to sacrifice something rather than to gain by it. I'm sincere in that.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. The Briarcatch scenario is a good one.
I wonder if you'd like to go away and consider that and come back with some new language.
If you if you'd like us to, we'd be glad to do that.
I wish you would. Any of the committee object?
What?
Go away and work some new language. We'll come back, you'd probably come back, if you get it done by Monday, Steve, we'll take it up again on Monday if it's agreeable with the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I know what the chair is trying to do, but I think we can't be too disingenuous about that. I mean, Senator Stevens is already on record, and a delegation is on record, so they really won't be too persuasive, I think, if the legislature says, golly gee, we really don't want to do this. But I understand how...
I don't want to see the big benefits, because I don't care what Ted and Frank say back there, really. I mean, naturally, I want them to assist us. But if we send them some glowing resolution here and tell them, oh my golly, here's you got to help oil Alaska to get done with this thing, they'll use that against those two guys in their arguments and say, hey, you guys don't know what you're talking about. You're talking about this here, and here's your own legislature sits up there, and here's what they think about it. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but if they go to them and say, Ted and Frank, your own legislature says they really won't do anything for Alaska, but they're just going along to help the country, that's not going to
be. It doesn't make any difference in the scheme of things what Ted and Frank say, because it's going to be an administration policy, and if it's the President of the United States and his advisors think this is a good move, that's going to happen, and then whether you and I are sitting back there.
We can say it raised more money for dispensing.
In fact, that sounds better if you and I were sitting back there, right?
For
I mean, if you just cool it down a little bit and make it not so that we're all these wonderful things that's going to happen to Alaska is what I'm getting at.
Well, I agree with you entirely, Mr. Chairman. In fact, we thought we had done that, and that was our intent was to try and show the benefits to the nation without highlighting the benefits to Alaska. I think that we were trying to be honest that Alaska's going to get something from it, because we didn't think that we could convince anybody that Alaskans would come back to Washington to ask for a change of federal law simply to benefit the lower 48. But
stranger things have happened. Will you be back on Monday?
That's the will of the committee.
Would the chair allow a word for Mr. Maynard, who is the oil expert for this property law?
I have no problem.
Robert Maynard, Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law.
I guess the question would be what the Department and the Administration think about SJR 12. Have you had a chance to see substitute language proposed by Mr. Silver? And tactically, what, if any, reference should be made to the issue of how export would affect state revenue?
I can't speak to the Administration. Perhaps Mr. Widow can speak to that more accurately. I can say that we were involved in an export activity previously back in 1979, 1980, a three-way swap. On the revenue issue, it is clear, and I think the Department of Revenue has had figures on that, that any scenario for export would help the state's revenues. The question has always been whether or not, given the potential detrimental effects of pushing an export activity with regard to reaction in Congress, et cetera, would outweigh the potential benefits that may or may not arise depending upon the probability of it occurring. Last time we tried an export activity back in 1979, we almost made it. We had the president and the president of Mexico had both agreed that it would be a good idea. It was a three-way swap. It was a swap between and Mexico state royalty oil under a provision of the then Export Administration Act that was looser. We got hit at the very end with the gas lines, the Iranian crisis, so Ohio canceled the Pactex line, and what came out of it eventually was a more restrictive legislation on exports. And that's always been the balancing act later on, is whether or not the potential bad effects of the state of Alaska pursuing it were worth the risk of getting it. I have not had a chance to see the, I have seen SJR 12. I have not had a chance to review the proposed substitute language. I'd be glad to sit and review it and have a comment later on if that's what you wish.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Steve, make sure that Alaska says, hey, we're going to benefit from this, all right, but the benefits to the federal people in the rest of the United States would be far more pronounced than ours.
Certainly, we agree, Mr. Chairman. As I said, we felt that was our intent in proposing the substitute, and we'd be happy to try and make the case even stronger in the new language that we presented.
Are you going to return, Senator?
I can't. No.
Oh, okay. We're just going to take up. Do you know any of these gentlemen here? Do you have any problem with any of these gentlemen?
No, I've heard.
But the governor wants.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have the Commission on Judicial Conduct, and we have three names here to approve or disapprove. They have their resume, I believe. I know I can vouch for Michael Holmes, and I don't know if you know him or not.
Yes, I do. I can vouch for two of them personally and one by reputation. I don't see any problem with any of them, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any problem?
I can vouch for your good judgment.
Okay, then would you write a letter saying that we brought them up and discussed them and there was nothing bad or good? In other words, we're on our own. I don't want to send some back there that's just going to make Alaska look like we're...
raise our revenue.
Yeah, well, Jesus, that's just like... Because whether we like it or not, you know, it isn't so much that not the politician, but the common man thinks it's wise.
They think we're sending oil over there right now.
Oh, yeah.
They really
do. Matter in hell about it.
Yeah. How come all that goddamn Alaskan oil is
going to
Japan?
Going to Japan. And they say, no, we didn't send anything over there.
We're shipping all the way down through the Panama Canal. By the time it gets to you guys, there's a high freight bill on it that you're paying more for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the Ridge resolution that I think makes sort of explains the whole situation.
Yeah. Well, once again, gentlemen, you've been extremely active.
Extraordinarily.